Hello, everyone. My name is Brooklyn Myers, and I am an Elixir newbie. My goal is to help people adopt Elixir and grow as developers while doing the same myself. I do that by documenting and sharing my own experience in the Elixir industry. It's been an incredible journey so far, and I look forward to taking the next step with you. So, let's jump in to the Elixir Newbie Podcast. Just some announcements before the start of this episode of the Elixir Newbie Podcast. The first announcement is that the ElixirNewbie.com website is now live. You can see the podcast. You can also see all of the different blogging that I do now on that site. There's going to be more things that I add to it over time. So that site is going to grow and evolve. And if you want to check that out, that's going to be at ElixirNewbie.com. Last thing as well is that this is the last episode of the first season of the Elixir Newbie Podcast. I can't believe how much has happened since I decided to talk into a mic once a week and put that out for people to hear. It's been a really amazing experience. So I want to thank everyone who has helped make this such a fun and cool experience. And I hope you're all excited for the second season of the Elixir Newbie, where I am going to be coming back, just going to be taking a break between the first season and the second season so that I can do a bit of recharging, do a bit of recovery, as well as focus on some other side projects and content creation that are happening. So look forward to that. As always, you can always still reach out to me. You can always reach out to me on Twitter. I'm still happy to pair program with people and help people out. And if you're trying to get into Elixir, you know, I'm still here, even if the podcast just isn't being recorded week to week, but we'll let people know when the second season is going to come out. I don't have those dates just yet, but once that is more of a solid plan, I'll let everyone know what the plan's going to be there and when they can start expecting more Elixir Newbie content. So without further ado, welcome to the 15th episode, the final episode of the first season of the Elixir Newbie Podcast. Got to have a very cool conversation with Jeffrey Mathias. So thank you so much, and hope you have a good one. Think of your tests as stating the problem that your code solves. And once that's done, writing that code becomes easier. Moreover, tests not only state the problem, but they also verify that the solution is correct. They're an almost indispensable part of software engineering. Now, that's a quote from Testing Elixir, Effective and Robust Testing for Elixir and its Ecosystem. And I read Testing Elixir soon after adopting the language. It has inspired how I write code and how I test that code. And I discovered the book by attending a meetup where Jeffrey, the co-author of Testing Elixir, gave an early version of his Elixir conference talk on maintainable test factories. And Jeffrey was incredibly kind. He took the time to answer every one of my questions. He even stayed late afterwards. And he was one of the first people who really made me feel welcomed into the Elixir community. And with that said, I am incredibly grateful to welcome Jeffrey onto the podcast today. Jeffrey, thank you so much for being here.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me on. I'm honestly, anything making it easier for people to get into Elixir is awesome. So I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I appreciate that. It is incredibly exciting to have you here. I'm really looking forward to talking about testing, talking about code, helping people that are new learn how to get into that. And before we dive into any of that incredibly useful, knowledgeable stuff, I have to know, what is Scare Factory? Because I caught you on a recent episode of Beam Radio, and you teased that you were involved with this, these animatronic robots. And unfortunately, there wasn't time in the episode to go over it. So I would love to hear what is that and how did you get involved with it?
Yeah, there is an entire industry around creating animatronic monsters for haunted houses. And so I don't know how it works in post-COVID times. In pre-COVID times, every spring, there's a big trade show where people go through and they show off their newest monsters, and they take orders, and then they spend all summer just producing them just as fast as they can, and then deliver them in the fall in time for Halloween. And so, what I was doing is, the dirtiest and probably least exciting part of all of it is I was a production welder. And so I would get, I'd get like really badly drawn technical drawings. There were air quotes there for anybody who's listening to the podcast version. And I'd have to go figure out, I'd make a prototype based off of it. The thing they'd made forever, but they just really didn't have very good drawings on it. I'd make a prototype. So it was the articulated steel frames inside of the monsters that I was making. And so I'd make a prototype and then figure out how to build out jigs so that I could just make a whole ton of them as quickly as I could. And so I'd then spend the next 3 days just doing the same welds over and over and over again. And then the art department got to take what we built and turn it into, and so I would fit it with pneumatic cylinders. And they were designed to run, off of air. And we're talking about some stuff, you know, being 4 feet tall. Some things that we worked on were, you know, 15 feet. So some really big monsters, and then the art department would turn them into the actual creatures. So they used a lot of expanding foam and paint and stuff like that. It was a challenging job, because it was dirty and hot, but it was also fun, and I definitely was a better welder after that. So. And it's probably the only degree that any of the skills I learned, sorry, the only job that any of the skills I learned getting my, my sculpture degree, actually landed. Right. So
that is extremely cool. Definitely a cool way to, integrate great, sculpting and engineering and kind of, you know, I imagine there's a lot of problem solving. It seems like throughout your career, I know you've kind of, bounced around a few different industries as far as I understand it, and have eventually wound into software, but it seems like there's been this common thread of solving problems and elements of engineering. And I'm definitely curious how you went from building these robots to software. I think there were some steps along the way, getting the furniture design, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, but there was actually 3 years in the mortgage industry selling mortgages too. And I got pretty burned out on that. So I got tired of being poor. I was originally an auto mechanic and then a vintage Vespa mechanic. And then I was making the monsters. And I just got tired of being poor. And so I decided to make a big switch, and I worked for about 3 years selling mortgages. And I hated it. So, I was thinking about going back to school and getting an MBA maybe. And, my now wife, then girlfriend convinced me that I, should maybe think about something more artistic. And that's when I remembered that I had actually, pretty much the day after I graduated, with my degree in sculpture, I learned about, industrial design, and I'd really wanted to do that, which is product design. And I'd wanted to do that ever since. And somehow 8 years later, I'd forgotten about that. So she prompted me to do that. I went back to school and I spent a few years working as a furniture designer. During that time, my daughter showed up and we were in a place where we needed more money, than a, furniture designer was making. And so I'm super fortunate that was in 2012 that I made that switch, and that was right when boot camp started being a thing. And so I am a graduate of one of the very earliest boot camps. In fact, it was called Dev Boot Camp. I think it's one of the major reasons we call them boot camps. And they shut down a few years ago, but so yeah, I made that transition there. And the thing that, with exception of the mortgages business, the thing that's been the common theme for me is I like to make. You say problem solve, and that's, they're one and the same to me, right? I like to make things. I am a maker. And so one of the things I really liked about moving over to software was I didn't feel like I was selling out. A lot of the things I really, really enjoyed about designing furniture and working with CNC machines, and, you know, focusing on things like modularity, a lot of that actually transferred over. A lot of the thought process was similar enough that, it scratched a lot of the same itch. And then what's really interesting is that with testing, there's a really fast feedback loop. And especially because I actually test drive my code, right? So I write a test and then I go pass it. So I get this really quick feedback loop that says, you know, that helps me, I, you know, get an idea that I'm on the right path. Whereas when you're doing physical stuff, it can be way further between the idea and having to get through a prototype. And even with like 3D printing, you're talking about a long period of time just before somebody sees it and you get any sort of feedback. So the feedback cycles are really nice in software. I still make things like actual physical things though, for fun. So yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, I found that because you have that fast feedback loop, you're constantly iterating over the problem. You get to see if you're going in the wrong direction. It just, you know, that's why having a good test suite is so important on a code base, being able to know that the changes you're making aren't breaking anything, getting to feel confident. I'm really curious, what was it like transitioning into software? Obviously, you had a background that was conducive. You had some of the existing skill set, more of the general skill set, and maybe not the specific knowledge of the languages and tools. That was something you had to pick up at the boot camp. But now you're in a state in your career where you're working on incredibly interesting problems. You know, you're at a place where you're like senior of seniors in some sense, you know, working on really interesting stuff, solving incredible challenges. But when you first began, I want to know, what was it like for junior dev Jeffrey?
Terrifying.
What was that feeling? How?
Yeah. So starting with Dev Bootcamp, I showed up. I was in a cohort of, I think, like 45 people, and I constantly felt like everybody understood everything more than I did, that I was playing catch up, that, and I, they worked really hard to help people understand the, difference, or so they always talked about, like, here's your comfort zone and here's your panic zone, and right that thin line right on between is where you're going to be doing the most learning, right? And so I was pushed. It was a 10-week program. I learned enough to get my first job in 10 weeks, but that was not an ideal time frame, and we were still learning, right? I mean, I was literally, when I say one of the earliest boot camp graduates, like, I'm guessing that there are probably fewer than 100, you know, 200 maybe nationwide before me out the door. And so they're just figuring it out. And so we were pushed really hard, and I kept just in the back of my head thinking, like, oh, I got to support a wife and a kid. Like, I cannot fail. And that idea that I couldn't fail actually caused me to carry more anxiety and concern. If there was anything I could go back and tell Jeffrey then, like, it was going to be okay. Like, there are a lot of engineering jobs, and like there are enough for people who learn to code and get it done and are tenacious enough to go find a job, like to manage to land that first job. Like, the career is there. But so yeah. And then after that, I managed to talk my way, into plenty of interviews. I think I probably interviewed with about 20 companies. And I got a sum total of probably 3 offers out of all of that. And one of them was in California, and my wife asked me very nicely if we could try and stay in Colorado, which is where I am now, Denver, which is good too, because the money they were offering me was not going to be great for supporting a family. Another one, I had one rescinded. So that was pretty awesome. I had a job offer that I verbally accepted, and then they came back and said, "We're so sorry. The CEO wants to interview you herself, the non-technical CEO, and she didn't like my answers and felt like I was too inexperienced, and withdrew the offer." And then I had one for that was basically like software engineer for 6 months and then turned me into a project manager. And I had found this awesome skill that I was getting to be creative. And the last thing I wanted to do was focus on and work on focusing on like helping other people be creative, right? Efficiently. And so I wasn't super excited about that. And the last one I had was an internship, offer. I had, made my way into like managed to get an interview with SendGrid, which is a email company. At the time, they were a lot smaller than they are now. Now they're part of Twilio. They didn't know what to do with me. I failed a bunch of the technical questions in the interview. And then I got to the coding part and I sat down and I explained my thought process the entire time I live coded, which were skills that I had learned at Dev Bootcamp. I solved the problem, and then by the end of it, I had come up with the more efficient solution and started explaining what I was going to do. And the guy's like, yep, good. We got it. Like, I was like, I can go rewrite this. And he's like, no, we're good. We're good. And so they weren't sure what to do with me. So they made me an offer as a intern. And so I clarified with them that it was a basically an extended job interview. And not just, you know, like a 3-month thing. And that was that. And it was, and so I took the other job was a full paying, like full benefits job. But again, I didn't want to, I was more excited about what I was seeing at SendGrid. And I knew that it came across as a much better learning environment. And so, I took the internship and a month later they made me a full-time offer, and it panned out to be the right thing. So, but when I got there, again, just constant fear, right? Imposter syndrome is real. Let's put it that way. So I still deal with it to this day sometimes, right? Like the better known you get, the more you feel like people expect you to know what the hell you're doing. I don't know what I'm doing. in fact, one of the best things that we do as software engineers is build out the skills to make progress when we don't know what we're doing, right? To figure things out, to try things. And so we build out a list of steps, whether we're aware of it or not, of things that we go through, like, hey, I'm stuck. Okay. You know, do I go look at documentation? Do I dive into source code? Or how am I going to go about debugging this thing? But we spend a lot of our time not knowing what we're doing. And I think that for me, one of the biggest things getting into this industry has done was made it okay to make mistakes in a way that I hadn't been okay with for most of my life. And Lord knows, if you're not okay with making mistakes, this is a tough industry to be in. I remember at Dev Boot Camp, one of my instructors, you know, I pulled him over and I was pairing with somebody and we're like, does this code look good to you? He's like, I don't know, run it. And he was like, well, but does it look like it'll, he's like, I don't know, run it. And like his whole point was, it's very cheap to run code. And it's like, yeah, but it might error, you know, like in my head, getting it to not work the first time was a problem. And thank goodness, everywhere I've worked has been, pretty good about understanding, mistakes. And it's not about the mistake. It's about what you do with it. Like, oh, you made a mistake. What did you learn? Did you incorporate that? Right. Early Jeffrey, I know that was a pretty long diatribe, but I think the biggest reason, I gave that much detail is I just want people to know that like my career path, first off getting in, you know, getting, it was not easy. Like it's not even that it wasn't easy. Like I just had to keep trying, like finding that first job, was not easy. There's plenty of time where I spent doubting myself. If I hadn't had an absolute need to make it work, I might not have, but it paid off and I love what I do. I've had a great career. I've been really lucky. So, but it, you know, it's one of those things where it's a mixture. Hopefully we all get luck, but you have to match it with hard work basically, right? To be able to take a true advantage of it.
It's a very interesting path for most people getting into the industry, because I think a lot of people have that experience of you work really hard to find your first job. Finding your first job is the hardest part of software.
Yes.
Like there's really boot camps have come in and really provided a way to help people into that. But it's still really hard. There's really not a clear path from A to B for your first job. And everyone kind of has to just struggle to find it. And from there, you're on the ladder and you can just keep climbing as long as you work hard. But that first rung is so hard to get to. And what's funny is like, I do think that you have to have some love for encountering a problem and then solving it, because that's all it is, right? You encounter the problem of how do I find my first job, and you solve it. And you're like, great, all my problems are over. It's like, no. Now you have the problem of how do you onboard onto this team? Like they've given you a shot. You need to work hard to live up to that challenge. And hopefully, you know, this is a huge thing that I think juniors should prioritize is like, don't prioritize pay compared to prioritizing, like you said, a good learning environment. You know, it's classic rise over run, just like optimize how much better you're going to be in a year, not how much you're going to be paid for that first year.
That's fantastic advice. So My brother's actually been in the industry for 25 years now, but it was, you know, it was much less when I first got started. And his one piece of advice to me is as long as what a company does isn't against your morals, like, don't care. What you care about is the team that you're working with, the people you're going to be working with, and whether or not, you're going to learn and whether or not they're people you want to show up and deal with on a day-to-day basis. And, to this day, it was a gamble to take an $18 an hour, which is still, you know, it was half decent money in 2012 or whatever, 2013. It was a gamble to take that, right, over a full-time job with salary and full benefits. But hands down, it was the right choice. It was a great company to work for. They focused on finding people that played well together. It was a really supportive environment, and I learned very quickly. And in fact, I had a rare opportunity too, and this is actually a secret to how I got started with, one of the major factors in my career, which was testing. I had learned at Dev Bootcamp that test-driven development was important, but I hadn't really gotten the skills down. I was dedicated to it. So I talked a lot about how important it was when I was interviewing with SendGrid, only to get there and realize they didn't really do that. And then about a month in, right about the same time I got made a full-time offer, my team split. It was something I'd known is coming. And the guy who'd interviewed me, who is now my team lead, said, "Okay, Jeffrey, we are now 100% TDD team and you are teaching us." And so 30 days into my career, I became the expert on test-driven development and had to level up fast. And so it was definitely a trial by fire. I spent the next 4 months just constantly figuring out everything I could, rethinking it. And it was really neat though, because they got to the place where, like, they knew where I was, they knew how experienced I was, but got to the place where they, and I was working with two engineers at that time, two engineers that had, you know, 15 years of experience. So talk about intimidating, right? I was terrified. But they were supportive, and you know, they both got to the place where they had, like, they understood it pretty quickly to the idea where, or to the place where they were then proposing ideas to me, and I did, and together we did a pretty good job of forming that. But that couldn't have been, like, that was one of the most formative things that possibly could have happened in my career, and it happened right away, to the point where I actually called those two engineers out in the acknowledgments to the book, because it was that career defining for me. So,
and it's amazing what you learn when you get to collaborate with other people. Like, we draw all of our good ideas, all of our inspiration from the other people that we get to interact with. And of course, some of it is churning on the idea yourself and spitballing, but you know, without other people, it just doesn't become what it could be.
Other people, for sure. Yeah,
exactly. And I'm really curious, because I know you have obviously a lot of strong opinions on testing, and I think development, everyone has strong opinions, and those opinions don't always align. So how do you collaborate effectively with other developers?
Oh, yeah. So I think one of the biggest things, and I can credit this back to kind of my introduction into coding, is the recognition that two people almost invariably write better software than one. And with that means that you sometimes have to compromise. Sometimes whatever your solution is not what you were sure you wanted, you may be in a place where it's barely anything you wanted, but, and so sometimes compromise is really ugly. It's like, yeah, we compromised that we weren't going to argue, like, and then we did your thing. But, worst case scenario, if you build something you don't like, you get to find out either it was good and it worked and you learned a new thing, another option of doing things, or it didn't work and you were right, which is, you know, you don't call it out. You just give yourself a little internal back pat. And more importantly, then you are sure, you know, you are in a place where whoever you're working with learned, the organization learned, and you still probably learned something, right? Like to the point where, and so then you go try the other thing, right? I mean, like I said, we constantly fail. So if we're, one of the biggest keys to cooperation is recognizing that, like, you're going to fail. There's always going to be failure. the less time, you know, spend time designing, but then nothing you do is sacred, right? Like, cause half the things that I come up with are bad ideas. Like, and the only way to find out is to try them and keep going, so be open to other people's bad ideas too. Sometimes it turns out they're good ideas and you can learn, right? I also have made it a pretty big emphasis in my career to try and identify places that emphasize team, or, you know, that focus on team, like teamwork. I've tried to avoid any place that was looking for rock stars and ninjas. That was I don't know if that's still a common thing, but when I was looking for jobs, for a while there, it was like, yeah, are you a rock star coder? Like, no, and I don't want to work with them either. And in fact, my superpower is enabling other people to code faster and better. I am not a fast coder. I probably will never be. But what I do is raise people up around me and get them. And so a lot of times there are people who are very fast coders. I help them be better coders. And then that way they're fast and good. Enabling other people has been a lot of what I do. And so that goes back to the collaboration.
Sure. I think there seems to be this, as far as I can tell, there's this transition you go from as you become more experienced as a developer. You go from being an addition statement to a multiplication statement. And individually, you know, at first, you just want to add to the team. You just want to make sure that whatever contribution you're doing is positive. You're making the team go faster, go better, you know, write quality code, whatever it is. But as you become more experienced and you learn how to share knowledge and collaborate and contribute in that way, you stop worrying about your individual output and start worrying about the collective output.
That's a yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the other opportunities I had when I was, because of being at SendGrid, I'd say it was sometime within the first year, we switched to being pair programming only too. And while I like that and I do fine in that environment, I don't necessarily recommend it. I don't have strong opinions on that. But that again just drives home that like nothing's your code, right? Yeah, it fundamentally comes back to nothing we do is sacred, right? And so learn from everybody else and raise them up.
I love that. It reminds me of an expression my former boss used to say all the time, which is code is cheap, ideas are expensive. You know, you wrote something. Yeah, sure. It took you 3 days. Throw it away. It's the idea is what was expensive about that. And same thing with pair programming. I love pair programming. I've talked about it before. I think it might have been the last episode on the podcast was pair programming and the benefit of two heads and, you know, getting to bounce off of each other, getting that feedback, you know, early on, having someone interject and say, hey, you're about to go down this path. Have you considered this way? Yeah. And it's a lot easier to do that early on than it is late game. And yeah, that's something.
In addition to that, sorry.
My apologies. Lag. Latency. Yeah. We're blaming latency. My apologies. Go ahead.
No, good. It's just, I want to build on what you were saying, but since this is, a podcast focused towards newbies, Elixir newbies, one of the best things to realize is that even if the pair is completely uneven, somebody is way more experienced in one way, you know, in whatever, some aspect than the other, both people bring value. And so the lower down you are, the less confident you are. One of the tricks I found that was really helpful is instead of leveraging questions as the way to steer things. So a lot of times people will be going really fast and you're like, you know, and you maybe get the sense that like either like, I'm not sure they've got this all the way thought out. Or, I'm not sure that's going to work. Just ask questions. Be like, hey, I'm not sure I'm following. Can you get me up to speed on this? A lot of times when people stop to explain it to you, they'll realize like, oh crap, this isn't going to work, or oh no. And so like, just if you're afraid to push your ideas because you feel like you're the less skilled pair, recognize that asking the right questions can be as important and contribute just as much as if you were driving the design itself. And you learn again, you build confidence. The more it happens, the more you realize like, oh, I do actually have ideas and I do have an idea of what I'm doing here. And if not, like, if, you know, if it's not because you thought something was wrong, because you didn't know what's going on, just again, ask. Your pair should be keeping you up to speed. It's an opportunity for them to get better at what they're doing as well, and it will still make the code better. So, that's my little diatribe on that.
Yeah, I've had the chance to pair with people both far more experienced than me and somewhat less experienced than me. And in both cases, I've found tremendous value having them there to question, to ask. Even just keeping you focused is actually a like unspoken value of pairing. Having someone else that you're accountable to and knowing that if they get lost, you've kind of done something wrong. So you have to communicate and talk through your code. It's like having a rubber ducky who, you know, you're actually, so for the podcast listeners, they're not going to see this, but I do always have a rubber ducky right beside my desk, someone to talk to and think out your problem with. Even just trying to wrestle with the ideas can be beneficial if you're more junior. On that point of how to help juniors and beginners, I'm really curious if you have any advice for how do you help juniors grow? How do you onboard them? You've talked about TDD. I'd love to hear about if you have any advice for how to get into testing more as someone who is, you know, relatively new to programming. Do you have any advice to share there?
Yeah, I mean, so there's two things that have to that seem to be really important if you're especially for people who are competent at coding already and already are okay with testing. Switching over, the thing there just requires patience with yourself and being in a place where you're given the space to do it, right? And so not everybody has that option at work if they're lucky enough to be working professionally as a coder. And in that case, potentially you work on it on side projects. The biggest thing to know when you're going through it is that it is possible to write your tests first. The second thing to know is that it's okay if you're not sure what you're doing to write the code and then what you're trying to do there. And in fact, your intro ties into this, to the episode, where you're talking about the test as a problem that you know, is a, bother. I wrote the thing and I can't remember exactly what it was. It's actually
a stating your problem that the code solves, right?
Thank you. And so it's actually a paraphrase of a quote from Charles Kettering, who was head of research at Delco, which was a car electronics company. He actually invented the automotive distributor, if I recall correctly, or at least led the team that did. But it's the way I love to think about testing. But the catch is that what you're trying to do when you're trying to learn to test is you're trying to know enough about what you're testing that you can write that test. And so if you don't know enough about what you're doing, one of the cheats early on is to actually write, and the more complex the thing is, the harder it is to typically know what to write the test. And so go write the code and use that to define your test and then throw out your code and go rewrite it. And anything you already wrote is just useless. Not because it's not necessarily where it could end up looking identical, but you're not, what you want to do is rewrite your code to that test. There should not be a line of code. You know, there should not be a single line in your code that isn't responding to something that test is testing. And so, people are, you know, one of the places where people regularly tell me that they get stuck test driving is when they don't know. They're like, yeah, it's just completely out of my league. Well, if you don't know enough to write your test, you don't know enough to write your code because you can't state the problem you're trying to solve. So again, like, go write some code. Usually what it means for me, if I'm in that situation, I'm not writing the full implementation. I'm writing the thing that's the fuzziest to me, right? I'm just focusing on that piece of it. And then I get enough understanding of that I can actually design the test. The other big thing, and this is like, the biggest piece of starter advice you can possibly give somebody, is when you are testing your code, you are not testing how your code solves the problem. You are only testing that it does solve the problem. And so what I mean by that is that your test shouldn't care if you're using a list or a a map or whatever to solve it. All your test should care about is, I'm sure we've heard about this. I like to say the magic box, but people refer to it as a black box of testing, where you draw an imaginary box around the code under test, and your test should have no idea what's inside of that. It should know the information it sends in during the function call. It should know the information that comes out, and it should know about any side effects. So if calling that function sends other calls, and that is it, right? The test should only be focused on those things. And if you do that, A, your test will be way less brittle. And B, you'll start to develop a sense of how to test.
I love that exercise. I really do. I think that is such a cool way, because if you write the test first, or sorry, not first, but if you write the test after and you're not yet comfortable with writing it first and you delete your code, that's actually a great test for exactly what you're saying, which is testing behavior as opposed to implementation is one of the ways I've heard it referred to as, is you don't care exactly how your code works. You care that it does the thing you want it to do. And if you delete your code and then you're forced to write it the exact same way, that might be an indication that you're testing the implementation and not the actual behavior of it, especially like, when you're just learning how to write syntax, it's really hard to figure out, how do I test this thing? Like, I had that problem when I was like, how do I test a controller in Phoenix? It's like, I don't know the constructs to actually build that up because I don't yet know how controllers work in Phoenix. So going in and learning the code and then figuring out the test and then figuring out how to do it in the opposite order. That's really cool. I like that. I'm going to have to share that with more people.
Yeah, it's again, like it's regularly the thing I hear with folks that are trying to like I tried to TDD, but then I hit this thing and I didn't know what to do. Like, cool, but just go do enough playing around to be able to write the test, right? And then the other thing too is that once it's gone, once your code is gone and you've got that test, you get to play, right? Like, one of my favorite things in what we do is knowing I've got a solid test. And then trying different implementations to see, that's how I've developed my style, my sense of style. You know, with Elixir, I'll play around with, I'll be like, huh, maybe I should have actually solved this with different function clauses, right? Maybe these function clauses are hard to read. Perhaps I should have instead just used something out of the enum library to handle this. Like, if I've got good tests, I can safely go play around. Right. And so, building out tests gives you that safety. You get to play. You just get to have fun. Refactoring code that, like, well-tested code is just fun. There's a Rubyist, and actually, I think she's now a Go engineer. Oh my goodness. I just blanked. Katrina. Oh, she's so awesome too. She started Exorcism.io and she's a friend of mine, and I just blanked on my own friend's name.
Owen?
Yes, thank you, Katrina Owen. So Katrina Owen, thank you so much. So Katrina Owen, God, good news is she's probably not going to listen to this podcast. So Katrina Owen, I think, is one of the people who helped imbue me with like my sense of love of refactoring, that it's one of those places where you get to be more expressive than you were the first time around.
It's a cool feeling watching your code go from this, like, it's kind of like if you're building, like, I don't know why I'm thinking of it, but I've never done any woodwork, but it's kind of like building a chair. You know, you have this like very rough outline of a chair and it just starts off as this like rough cut of wood, and then you're kind of polishing it away and it still does the same job as a chair, but you know, it looks so much more beautiful and clean. And it's very cool to see this like garbled mess that you started with turn into something extremely simple and clear. That's like where the art of code comes in.
It's fun. And that's one of the reasons why I enjoy Elixir, is because I feel like I can write elegant code, which to me is simple and readable, right? It's the simplest thing I can do that other people can understand. If it looks simple, but it's complex, then you failed. That's in the clever realm instead, right? But I find that overall Elixir syntax allows me to be fairly expressive, and write things that are easy to read and they do what they're supposed to do. And I enjoy that. But sometimes finding your way there, sometimes there's a really ugly implementation first, but it does the job, right? So,
when that's the beauty of writing the test first and knowing that you've at least stated what you want to solve, it is so much easier. And this is one of those ways to combat the perfectionist mindset, the, you know, fear of writing any line of code because it's going to be wrong. Write a bad solution first and then write a good solution. It's so much easier to write a good solution once you have a bad solution in place.
It really, really is. A lot of people are surprised when I do code reviews. I tend to spend more time focusing on the tests. And one of the big reasons, or even when they're pairing with me, I spend more time on the test than I do necessarily the code. And it's not that I don't care about the code. If we're in a hurry, though, and I'm going to pull the effort away from one of them, it's going to be on the code. Because as long as I have good tests, we can always refactor it, right? If we figure out that it's not necessarily the most performant thing, or it's ugly, or it's hard to read, we can always refactor it because the tests are providing that safety net. So,
I love that. It's interesting how people have different styles of reviewing and focusing on different things. And you always get to learn a lot when people jump in and review your code. That's a huge thing as a junior. If you can have people who will give you feedback, will give you, opportunities to grow and learn. And I'd love to transition to, talking a little bit about community.com. And I'm curious how, you know, first, maybe you can tell us a bit about what community.com is and the cool stuff that you're doing there. But I would love to hear, how are you doing onboarding at Community, and how do you kind of help people grow? Community, I think, is a shining example of a company with, you know, good morals and good culture. So I'd love to get some insight into that.
That's a great question. Do you want me to start with what we do first and then talk about the rest, or?
Yeah, sorry. I asked multiple questions at the same time. So I'd love to hear a bit about just community in general first.
Absolutely. So the quick version of is anybody with a fan base, musicians, influencers, even though I'm too old to know what that word means. And even like small businesses and even some larger businesses. Anybody with a fan base that has tried to use social media, has realized really fast that there's algorithms that choose who in your fan base sees the algorithm. And so, as a result, you can spend a bunch of time accumulating a really big audience and never actually have any real connection with half of them. And so we allow people to stay in touch with their fan base via text messaging instead. And somebody explicitly subscribes to you as a leader. And when you text, you can do segmentation. So you can target, you know, one of my favorites is, you know, a band in LA saying like, hey, targeting just people within a specific area, saying, hey, we're going to be at this bar tonight, come hang out with us, and having it happen, right? Or asking questions, and just getting feedback and helping, you know, understand their audience better. And one of the things that I really like about it, there's a couple of things that stand out. Like, I don't particularly get excited about messaging and, social media stuff. Like I mentioned already, I'm too old for that. I'm 42 and I'm jaded, right? But one of the things that I really like about what we do is that we are structured so that the fan information actually belongs to our leaders. It's not ours. So the leaders pay us. Like we have a monetization strategy that the people who are staying in touch with their fan base, they're the ones that pay us. We're not selling eyeballs. And that is a really nice change from the way that most of the solutions in our space work. And then the other thing is it's their audience. So when they leave, they can take it with them. And so I dig that. And then another thing that's nice about it is that when people respond, they're not responding publicly for other people. So it takes away a whole lot of the performance aspect of the internet. And that means that people aren't nearly as toxic. We still do a bunch of work to identify toxic messages. We definitely blur incoming photos from fans. If you know, those are some of the places we do employ some machine learning. But ultimately, the idea is just to get people to communicate, and meaningful communication, and trying to figure out ways to have meaningful communication at scale. And it's a challenge. It really is. So we have a lot of really awesome people at the company, but I'm going to be honest. One of the challenges that I've fought, and I've finally made some some movement on it. So 2022 is the year, is that we're not great at pulling in junior engineers. And part of that was because we were a remote organization very early, and remote situations are not particularly junior friendly. But turns out that most juniors now, doesn't matter whether or not they, you know, they don't really have an option of going somewhere and working face to face with people. And so we're working right now to develop it so that we can give them the attention they need when we start hiring. And that's a challenge. And it's been really frustrating for me, by the way, because we have a lot of people at the company who love mentoring, love teaching. We hire very much for people who play well with others. And, you know, part of that is sharing your knowledge, right? And then in fact, it kind of deprives some people of their growth to not be able to do that. And so, we are ramping up on that, but the thing we have done is pull people in that have experience in other languages and ramp them up on Elixir. And we leverage pair programming heavily for that. So, you know, that we'll give an option, some selection of books and stuff like that. One of the best I would recommend for people is just the Elixir in Action, Sasha Urich's book. Which, you know, sorry if my publishers listening to me, I didn't recommend the one from us, but I find that to be probably one of the most complete resources for just getting into the language. And so we push people to go through that. The biggest thing is you got to give them work time, right? Like you can't expect people, if you expect people to be completely motivated and do things on their own outside of work, then you're eliminating a lot of people that don't have that flexibility, you know, single parents. People have just different life situations. And so you have to give them time at work to be able to learn and read. And then the other one is just pairing them up and having them, you know, initially letting them get dragged along and ask questions, right? And then eventually, you know, in short, you know, not too long after, you try to get them switching so they're the ones who are doing the driving. And so pair programming is like the major tool. And then we have a, We also have a situation where people can sign up and every 2 weeks get randomly assigned to connect with another engineer and just work with them on their stuff for a couple hours. And so that's another way to get some more exposure. We have a pretty healthy backend guild. I think we're about 40 members strong at the company. And so that means we've got at least 30 Elixir engineers. The guild itself is a place where people can just reach out and ask for help. So Slack channels, people jump on things right away. We're a very distributed company. And so we've had to learn that we've had to just get it like culturally, we've had to learn that the written word is king, you know, or is important with what we do. Cause we've got people ranging from the Pacific time zone all the way to, UTC+1. And so we've got people in Ireland, Italy, Sweden, Nigeria, England, Austria. Did I say Italy? Italy. You know, there's often only 2 hours worth of communication, but if you put something in there, like I've never seen anybody's questions go long without getting answers. And so that's the other part of it, just being in a supportive environment. We also have Munch and Learns, it's Munch and Learn instead of Lunch and Learn because we're so spread. And so people will, you know, step up to teach things there too. One of the challenges I have is, and it's in front of me specifically, is figuring out how to get us to, be able to teach juniors and give them the support and structure they need. And I think that means we're going to probably ramp into it slowly. And I may actually be directly involved with that. It's going to be, each team has to make the commitment that like, hey, we're going to support this person and this is our strategy. So
it's a really hard problem, you know, figuring out how to, I mean, software, I love software because compared to many other industries, it's one of the most approachable. And it still has some work to go to make it so that anyone can get into it if it's something that they want to do. But compared to many other industries, you don't need a four-year degree. You can teach yourself. You can take a boot camp. It might take you longer, but there's always options. Right now, I see the challenge for businesses is, well, we could hire someone to do it and they can just do it right away, or we can hire someone who isn't there yet and then train them into it. And for a lot of businesses, it just doesn't make sense from a cost time perspective. At least that's the way to think about it, to hire that person and train them up. But then there's this terrible feedback loop where we don't actually get people to being seniors. And now there's a talent shortage, and that is hurting every business. So it's like this terrible prisoner's dilemma where everyone makes the choice that makes it worse for everyone else.
I think one of my biggest frustrations is when people take the time, like one of the concerns is like, people will leave, we'll train them up and they'll leave. Well, they'll leave only when they stop feeling appreciated, they stop learning, or they're not being paid fairly, right? So like what you need to do organizationally, if you're going to take those challenges on, is be able to fulfill those things, right? Help them have a career path. And in fact, we lost a candidate to another company who was really excited about us, but the feedback was like, you all were great and I would have happily worked for you. But this company had, it was 3 or 4 women that they had pulled out of a boot camp. And at this point, it was 3 or 4 years later, and they'd been promoted all the way, you know, they'd made it to senior, and they were still working there. And it's like, well, cool. That company is doing something right for their employees, and I cannot blame you for wanting to go check them out. Like, I think we do a lot of things really well, too. But, like, that's awesome, right, for people. I wouldn't have left SendGrid if my career hadn't, like, I was there for 2.5 years and it was great. And then I spent 6 months without a manager, and I spent in that 6 months, my growth stagnated. I was being used instead of being treated like an asset worth investing in. Right. And so, I left. Like, it was not the right place for me anymore. And so even a company that I hold in very high esteem still can flub it, right? Can still mess it up. So hopefully, you know, I don't know how many people out there are listening to their employers, but people get it in their heads. The other thing too about training juniors up is that they're going to do things the way you want them to do it. And that is huge. One of the challenges I've had, I've been thrown on a team that had it was a project with 12 senior engineers. And everybody had different ideas of how to do things, and every piece of the application looked totally different, and all the testing was different, and some of the testing wasn't very good, and and so some of the code wasn't very good, and it's one of those things where one of the best coworkers I've got is somebody who came in. He had 1.5 years of experience, but he was just open-minded. He decided that when he showed up, he was going to learn to test drive his code, and he did. And we gave him space and support to do that. He's a fantastic tester. He writes really good code. He spends a lot of time on things. And a lot of it makes it easy to work with him is that we do things very similarly. And it's not that he hasn't gotten to push in the other direction. I've learned as much from him, or at least I've learned a lot from him. So it's definitely shaped the way I do, I do my stuff as well. But the fact of the matter is that we work well together because we've developed, we've got similar styles, and we don't spend time wasted arguing about how to do stuff that doesn't matter. And there's a huge bonus to that versus having people arguing about some really pedantic things, basically trying to show off how experienced they are, or why they're the experts. So,
thank you for hiring
juniors. Yeah.
You shared some insight on the benefits of juniors that I'd never even considered before now. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing your experience on that. That is really cool.
Our entire organization is also clamoring from, because like mentorship, teaching people is just one of the ways that I mentioned this earlier. It's just one of the ways we improve, right? And we're lacking that. We're working on identifying and helping people mentor across the organization. So-and-so is good at this one thing. This person is lacking, and connect them your relevant, of their experience. But there's something to be said for like taking an actual engineer under your wing. It's incredibly rewarding for the right people. And ends up being one of the things they really enjoy about their jobs. Mm-hmm. And, absolutely. You know, we're at a time where we're in a place in the industry right now where a lot of people are changing jobs, and doing things to retain your folks is big. And one of the biggest things you can do is help them have a sense of purpose at work. So
I love that. Thank you you've given me a lot of new ideas today to think about and share. So thank you so much. I know this is going to be super valuable to a ton of people. We are running out of time, and I want to be conscious of your kind of limitations here, but we've talked about how to bring juniors into the industry, how to support new people entering the industry. And before we started recording here, you and I talked a little bit about inclusivity. I know that's something that is really important to you, and kind of as a final talking point before we do some outro stuff. I'd just love to hear what are your thoughts on how to bring more people into programming from all different types of backgrounds.
Yeah. So I'm going to be selfish, and I'm going to focus specifically on the Elixir community and bringing people into Elixir. And part of that is because there's a couple different ways that it's one of those things where Elixir's numbers in diversity are not great. The Elixir community, everybody's really, really nice, friendly, supportive. And I love that. I really appreciate that. But somehow that doesn't translate to we're bringing in new people who don't look just like us, right? White dudes with glasses and beards. Although, you know, the distinguishing feature between the two of us is that you have hair and, you know, I don't. Right? So one of there's a couple different things we need to do. And one of them is the leveraging, things like pulling in juniors from boot camps, finding people, you know, there are no Elixir boot camps that I'm aware of. God knows if there are, please somebody write me and tell me. There are no boot camps for Elixir specifically, but somebody who just learned a language in somewhere between, you know, 3 and 6 months, they can learn that one of their biggest skills is learning. Right. Like that's one of the major skills they learned out of that boot camp is how to learn fast. And so leverage that, you know, pull them in. That's one of the places that we should be pulling in diversity. And then another one. Now the challenge is there is you also need to make sure that you aren't just ending up with the people, everybody who's not a white dude lower down in your organizational structure. And so that's one of the things is that if you've got people though to teach, you're going to be able to attract engineers from other languages. You will be more attractive, and it's an opportunity for people to be an example. You're going to have a better time pulling in more experienced software engineers that just need to learn Elixir, and then they can be learning together, right? And one of the reasons I care so much, there's two major reasons why I care so much about improving diversity in the community. One of them is because it's just fundamentally the right thing to do. And I, sometimes I don't have the patience for anybody who's not aligned with me there. But the other one is that we have inherent biases in our software. Our software, our algorithms, everything is reflects who has made it. And it's things as simple. I was explaining to one of the people in our sales organization the last week. You know, one of the things is like just form validations. Like, what characters do you allow? I know, as a white guy, a white native English speaking American, I have a very limited worldview. Right. I have a very limited idea. And in my mind, you know, there's 26 letters upper and lowercase and that's it. I can try to be more expansive, but I'm still only working from my perspective. So all of a sudden, by just not making sure that my form validation is inclusive for certain characters, I have actually alienated users of my product. And like, that's an easy to reach one, you know, reach for one. There's a lot of things in like physical products that show the same thing, you know, like, motion detectors that don't register black people. How messed up is it? The idea that like, you can't wash your hands because somebody didn't factor you in when they were designing the faucet. That is inherent all throughout our technology, right? That kind of lack of oversight, and we just make better software. So not only is it the right thing to do to have a diverse team, it challenges everybody to grow. It helps broaden their horizons, but, it actually lends to a better product as well, just hands down. And so again, I think, you know, I really encourage companies to leverage the idea of hiring junior engineers as one of the ways to approach that, But you cannot let that be the end of it. You have to get people in to your organization as mid-level, senior, whatever your management structure is, you know, leads and directors and VPs. You've got to focus on doing that. And that is that once you start getting momentum, you'll be in good shape. The other thing though, too, is if you're in a place where you're doing that, the most important thing you can do is try to be self-aware of your current environment and make it one where somebody shows up, they're ready, they feel welcome, safe, and able to do their work. They don't have to go fight fights about systemic issues in your organization. And we do our best. And even, you know, like at community, and even there, we still have room to grow, right? Unfortunately, we've got people who are speaking up and identifying things and giving us opportunities to improve. But it has to be that people need to show up and be able to nitpick things. If they're arguing about like, hey, we're still using like pretty exclusive language, you know, like a pretty dicey language at this company, I don't feel welcome here. Like that's a fail. You like, for all the effort you put into trying to build diversity, you're not getting it. So there you go. Thank you for letting me share my feelings on all that.
Anytime, absolutely anytime. I love hearing, I know this is something that is incredibly important to you, and you do so much good, Jeffrey. Like really, thank you for helping.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for helping welcome me into this industry and helping welcome a lot of people into this industry, and you know, love and appreciate everything that you're doing. Is there anything just as a final things that you'd like to shout out to? We've talked about your awesome book, which I highly recommend everyone read, Testing Elixir. I will put a link to that in the show notes so that that's accessible for everyone else. Oh, you also have, I meant to mention, an email. Do you mind if I plug that here?
No, please. I was about to, so go for it. Yeah.
Perfect. Correct me if I'm wrong. help@testingelixir.com. Is that right?
That's it. Yep.
And people can ask you testing questions there if they're wanting to know more about testing, how to start with it, how to do some common stuff, some advanced stuff, as long as that is maintainable for you. I believe that's something that you're hoping to continue to do.
Yep.
Yeah, is there anything
else? And I have Testing Elixir. Well, so I've got testingelixir.com. I'm hoping over the holidays I'll finally get it spun up as a way to just kind of put out little pieces. And I'm at Idle Hands on Twitter. And I also have Testing Elixir. Testing Elixir on Twitter. And so once I get the site up, I'll also be spinning that up and probably start pushing most of my Elixir and testing related content through that. And and let the people who follow my personal profile deal with my rants about politics and racism. So yeah. But yeah, so I just wanted to throw out some thanks to you too, Brooklyn. I told you yesterday when we were talking that I actually learned from one of your recent posts, the binding, named bindings for the composable Ecto queries. So thanks for putting that out there. But you do something that was a huge one-up is a major tool in my career, which was as soon as you learn something, you find somebody to teach it to, or you start teaching it. That is how I am where I am. And so thank you for being an awesome example of that. And thank you for creating a lot of resources for people who are trying to get into this. For me right now, my goal was to get the book out. It was a long process for us to do it. And once I was past that mark, it was to figure out how to shift towards bringing in new people into the Elixir community. And so you putting out those kinds of resources is going to be a big part of how we can continue to increase how many people are using Elixir. So thanks.
Thank you, Jeffrey. That means a lot to me.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that.
Sweet.
All right. Well, that is going to be it for this episode of the Elixir Newbie Podcast. I could literally talk to Jeffrey for hours and on end. So at some point we do have to stop talking, but hope to stay in touch and keep chatting. Thank you everyone so much for listening. I hope you Elixir Newbies out there enjoyed this episode and learned a lot. I know that I did. I'm feeling very inspired. And if you want to chat, you can always send me a message. I'm at Brooklyn J. Myers on Twitter. If you want to practice TDD with me, do some pairing, you can always reach out. As long as that's maintainable, that's something that when people reach out, I always offer. So do feel free to reach out. I hope you all have an excellent rest of your week, and I will catch you on the next one.